Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Pim Leyveld about his recent work, History of Psycholinguistics, the Pre-Chomskyan Era, a work of scholarship that explores the wealth of psychological research in language that took place in the 150 years before the so-called birth of psycholinguistics. In this interview, we can only scratch the surface of this work, but we talk about many of the important figures in the field and see how crucial theoretical proposals have been made and long forgotten before their recent rediscoveries. And we consider how some researchers and their ideas came to be unfairly maligned in the linguistics collective consciousness. Today I'm delighted to welcome Professor Pim Leyveld to discuss his new book, A History of Psycholinguistics, the Pre-Chomskyan Era. It's a fascinating and engrossing work of enormous breadth and depth, surveying research on the psychology of language from the 18th century up to the 1950s. This book is the result of an enormous amount of historical research. What prompted you to take on that challenge?
Well, two things. First of all, I had noticed over the decades that my colleagues and my students generally believed that psycholinguistics came about during the so-called cognitive revolution in the 1950s, early 60s. So it's young science, and this is expressed everywhere, in textbooks, all over the place. Our discipline is, what, half a century old. Now, I knew this is wrong, and I felt it is apparently necessary that my colleagues will hear more about that. And I did know that psycholinguistics, and I mean empirical psycholinguistics, had its roots in the end of the 18th century. So that is almost 200 years earlier than the general belief, the general view on this. And I felt I should do something about it. The other reason why I wanted to do this is simply because I had myself always been interested in the history of the field. I've always been reading in the old books, the old fat German books, the old French books, the English books, the Dutch books. I had some overview of what had happened, and I felt this is the moment to do it. I had just stopped in doing my experimental work. I had become emeritus of my Max Planck Institute in Nijmegen, and this was a very nice next project because I could essentially do it all alone, without students, without teamwork, as I was used to do.
Sure. One thing that's sort of a commonplace of psycholinguistic research is that there's this cycle of forgetting that we sort of imagine that, well, notice that after 20 or 30 years, work is often forgotten about and not cited. But what you reveal in this book is that it goes back a lot further. Despite your experience, were you surprised by exactly how widespread this forgetting is?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been time and again much surprised by what I found. Theories, concepts, etc., that we all felt to be modern, new, just invented, just tested, you find them time and again back in the old literature. I can give you a whole list of examples. of such reinventions of the wheel. What had to be reinvented, for instance, in experimental psycholinguistics, in the theory of speaking, so how do we produce an expression, an intentional expression that is informative for the listener? These days, we have detailed theories of stages that you must go through in order to produce your utterance from the intention you have. And these theories have been developed, especially also in my own Max Planck Institute. And you test them by chronometric measurement. You try to determine which phase is taking place or which stage is taking place when and for what duration. And we have become very sophisticated in measuring durations of, for instance, when you name a picture, of recognizing the picture as an object, of retrieving the concept that goes with it, of retrieving the syntactic word that can express it, of retrieving its phonological code, and then of planning your articulation. All that has been studied extensively. However, this had all been done, at least to some rather impressive extent, in Wundt's laboratory, to be precise, in the years 1884 to 87, by James McKean Cattell, the young American. At the time, he was around 27. And he built all the chronometric equipment to do such measurements, such as a voice key to register the moment at which speech starts. When you, for instance, name a picture of a tree, you start saying tree, and you must then measure the moment in time that the articulation, the articulated word tree, begins. So James McKean Cattell invented a voice key, a very clever piece of equipment, and he did all the measurements to study the process of picture naming, of color naming, of number naming, of word reading, of letter reading, all these processes that we now have studied in endless amounts of experiments in recent decades. They had first been done in Wundt's laboratory and everybody had forgotten about them. I found a magnificent example. Other example?
Sure, yes.
I guess most of us experimental psycholinguists are familiar with Marcelin Wilson's cohort theory, which was developed when William was a member of staff in our beginning Max Planck Institute. That was a very influential theory and a very clever theory. It said, when you hear a word, the first sound of the word, the first phoneme or maybe two phonemes, will activate all the words in your mental lexicon, in your memory, that begin that way, right? So when you hear the word church, the initial ch will also activate the word chair, right? Or chunk or whatever. Then the next speech sound comes in, and then you reduce that initial cohort of words to just those words that begin with that particular initial stretch, that somewhat longer initial stretch, and so on. You keep reducing the cohort of potential but activated words until only one is left. That is then the word recognized. So that's the cohort theory. To my great surprise, I found that cohort theory in detail described with example words, etc., in the work by Exner, a Viennese neurologist, published in 1893. Amazing, an amazing feat. So you can find it in my book. It is one of the most beautiful examples. Interestingly enough, Exner did not do any experiment. He just proposed the theory, and that was it. Now, sometimes I think if we had known this proposal, if we had kept it in the memory of our discipline, we could have been earlier to start testing it experimentally, and that would have been very useful. That's another example. Third example. In 1895, Meringer and Meyer published their classic study on speech error analysis. They had developed a system of systematically collecting spontaneous speech errors. In total, they collected an amount in the end of about 2,500 speech errors, spontaneous speech errors, and they analyzed them. And they developed a theory about how these speech errors come about, these anticipations, perseverations, interchanges, etc. That theory was forgotten, completely forgotten in the literature. And it was all rediscovered when people like Cohen and Frumkin, and then later many followers, in particular Merrill Garrett and Shattuck Hufnagel and so on, started collecting spontaneous speech errors, detecting the same patterns and deriving very similar theories. Completely forgotten. Other one?
Well, I was going to say there are so many, and one thing that strikes me very forcibly about those examples and many of the others in your book is the fact that it's suddenly one realizes that it's so much more difficult to formulate a new idea or to do even a new experiment that hasn't been done before in some way. Do you have that feeling in looking back in the discipline in more detail and subjecting it to this kind of scrutiny that suddenly the challenge isn't that much greater to do original work?
Well, there is a general difference, I should say, between what was done during the last few decades of the 19th century and during the first half of the 20th century. The daring theorizing was really a characteristic of the late 19th century. Such theorists like Exner, who proposed this theory that I just mentioned, the cohort theory, that you come across time and again. Wilhelm Wundt was very good in developing that sort of theories, but more generally, it was apparently practice for a scientist to first of all develop a theory. Now, that got lost to a large extent, not fully, of course, and there are always excellent exceptions, but it was lost to a large extent during the first half of the 20th century. The most characteristic feature of that period is that people were extremely keen on getting data and reporting data in tables, in graphs, but then not doing anything with them, not developing theory further. And that had several reasons. One of them was certainly that with the shift of the focus of the field from Europe to the Anglo-Saxon world, and especially to the United States, field came very much under the influence of behaviorism. And in the behavioristic periods in psycholinguistics, there was very, very little theorizing because there was this default theory, the SR theory, stimulus-response theory. Our task is to predict the response when we know the stimulus, or to predict the stimulus when we know the response. That's what we should do. And what happens in the whole trajectory between stimulus and response, in mind, one would say, is not our business. So they simply didn't want to think about mental constructions, mental processes. And that was a great loss. In short, the 19th century literature is theoretically much more interesting than most, not all, but most of the 20th century, early 20th century literature.
It's definitely the impression that you give in the book that the very promising position at the turn of the century, going up to the as you put it, the grand synthesis of Willem Wundt, is very much wasted in this sort of loss of theory, and for various other historical reasons, which we'll come back to. Why do you feel that the narrow behaviorist position was so appealing to its proponents at that time?
Yeah, that is a difficult question that has never been fully answered. One thing you could see happen even within the relatively small domain of psycholinguistics, small as compared to psychology as a whole. There's the following. The American early work in experimental psychology and also in psycholinguistics was introduced mostly by students of Wundt who had all worked in Wundt's laboratory, like James McKean Cattell and like Titchener and others, Angel in Stanford and many more, and Judd in Chicago. They had been students of Wundt. And so they knew how they should do detailed, precise chronometric experiments to find out how mental processes are organized. Still, these pioneers, American pioneers, very quickly moved to other type of business, namely to a practical approach. That is, they were not, as Wundt was, a general psycholinguist, that is, asking what are the processes that run language for us in our mind. No, they were mostly focusing on differential psychology, that is, what can we do with what we know and what we can measure for clinical purposes? What can we do to help children develop normally? We should develop mental tests. The term mental test was coined by James McKean Cattell, who had done this wonderful work in Wundt's laboratory. So there was a move to practical matters. And that is general when you read the famous old history of psychology by Boring. He is also noticing that American psychologists became differential psychologists. Now, that practical purpose was a good background against which behaviorism could develop. It is a no-nonsense background. The thing that's important is what comes out and what can we change and how can we steer things. Their behaviorism is a very natural ally because it tells you what should I do about the stimulus to get that result, to get the child learn quicker, to get a clinical phenomenon reduced, right, etc. Their behaviorism seemed to be the no-nonsense theory that you might want to use. So the whole interest in the subtleties of mental processes, and that is in the first place general psychologists, how do we human beings process language in this case, that was largely lost as a perspective in psychology and as a perspective in psycholinguistics.
Is it fair to say that the sort of shallow, short-term behaviorist approaches to some practical problems were or are actually quite effective, and that in some sense we have to make quite a lot of theoretical progress to find something that's both sophisticated and as effective, or am I overstating their case?
Well, what has been to some extent effective is in particular the work on child language development in the following sense. The child welfare institutions in several places, there were six of them, but two were concentrating on language development in Ohio and Minnesota. They developed grand scale statistical studies of how children, at what age levels children develop a vocabulary of a particular size, an utterance complexity of a particular level, a sound articulatory ability of a particular level. All these large scale measurements set norms. So now when you have a child and you think it is not developing well, then you can simply measure it, and you can see whether the child conforms to the norms. That is certainly useful. It is theoretically without much interest, but it is certainly useful. And I think those tests of verbal ability have been used to good purpose and are still being used to help children develop. But theoretically, it's without much interest. Now, on the other hand, I should immediately add that the few behaviorists who were considering general psychological issues as far as language use is concerned, people such as Skinner in the end, but before him, Osgood. Osgood is the better one, honestly. There have been about five or six behavioristic psycholinguists who have written monographs on the field as a whole, theoretical monographs. And those were people like Weiss, Cantor in particular, and Skinner. These books are not about data. What they are doing is just the following. They are putting the traditional terminology in psycholinguistics, the mental terminology, into a new language, which they themselves called behaviorese. And behaviorese is a language in which you express notions without involving mentalistic constructs. So, in objective terms, what do you see in the behavior? What is there in the stimulus? What is there in the context? But we are not going to talk about ideas, about intentions, about sentence schemas. No, that's all mentalistic. So what they've done is translating the traditional field into behaviorese. And they did it all in different ways. And they hated one another for the ways the other did this translation into behaviorese. They totally disagreed with one another.
So put it like that, it does have a ring of modernity to it.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yes. When you read this, you cannot understand really that this has been possible. It is really such a minor play of words among a bunch of scientists who have totally isolated themselves from the traditions in the field and from the major questions that had been raised long before they started writing.
I'd like to take this opportunity, if I may, then to go back to the origins of the field. In the first part of your book, you situate the origins of psycholinguistics in four roots.
Yeah.
Earliest of which is perhaps the 18th century sort of philological tradition.
It's
Hyman Steinthal that you inclined to credit working in the mid 19th century with actually formulating the discipline of psycholinguistics. Of course, this is obviously something we think of as a period of great scientific progress, Darwin et al. But then, in some sense, Steinthal seems to be drawing upon specific traditions in both psychology and philology that are already quite old by the time he's working. Is that your impression?
Yeah, he he's quite honest about it. He calls himself an Humboldtian. So he had never met Humboldt because Humboldt was already dead when Steinthal studied at Berlin. But he was much impressed by Humboldt, too much to my feeling. But one thing he picked up from Humboldt is really essential to the formulation of the aims of psycholinguistics. Humboldt had said that language is not what our philologists are studying, namely old texts. No, language is a tätigkeit, it's an activity. Language is what the speaker does. So that's a process theory of language. That, of course, is really an important insight from the point of view of psycholinguistics. We are creating language all day when we speak, and of course when we listen, but in particular when we speak. And that was the notion Steinthal accepted. And then he said, okay, if we want to understand language, then, and understanding language in that period was in particular understanding the origins of language, then we must have a psychological theory of the speaker. We must understand the properties of the activity the speaker performs. That was a totally new insight. Nobody had said that before. And Steinthal then goes all out to propose a psychological theory of the speaker. Now, there was no such theory around. He had to invent it. And in fact, he did. He invented a theory of the speaker. And that was the first psycholinguistic theory. And therefore, I have credited him with this invention. He was the first to formulate a psycholinguistic theory. Now, the theory he developed did not come totally from the blue air. He used an existing psychological theory, which had never been used for explaining language or the behavior of the speaker. But it was a theory that was around, and it was a theory by Herbart. Herbart was Kant's successor in Königsberg, and he was a mathematical psychologist, we would now call him. He developed a theory about how ideas attract one another or dispel one another in our minds, and in particular, how they get into consciousness or get pushed out of consciousness, and how they form conglomerates in subconsciousness, in your memory. That was Herbart's theory, and it was a mathematical theory. He provides all the differential equations. He was really very clever. Differential equations that govern this pushing and attracting of ideas. And that was the theory Steinthal adopted. And then Steinthal said, okay, what really are the ideas when they are in consciousness? And he said, mostly, they are words. So we have words in consciousness that represent meanings, conglomerates of ideas that are subconscious, that will never get into consciousness as a whole. We only have words in consciousness, spoken words, and we are speaking to ourselves the whole day. These spoken words are the conscious reflections of highly complex meaning processes in our subconscious. Now, interestingly enough, that theory was also reinvented. It was reinvented by Ray Jackendoff in his book about consciousness and in his recent book, A User's Guide to Thought and Language. Very interesting, just exactly the same thought. It had been forgotten now for, 150 years. Yeah.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And then another thing that seems curious when you describe Steintal's work in the light of Herbert's psychology is almost the idea that the psychology has something more in common, or it feels as though it's sort of naturally akin to accounts about, for example, the neural basis of thought.
Yeah, it is compatible with what we now call a connectionist view on what's going on in the mind, where there are large associative networks being built up, changed, where weights are changed by use and by repetition, etc., etc. There is a similarity there. So there's the old association theory of mind. It goes back to Hume and earlier. The British associationists in particular.
You discussed the foundational neurological work that was potentially relevant to linguistics and a foundation for psycholinguistics in another chapter in which you tackle the topic of the localization of brain functions.
Yeah.
And you give a very nuanced discussion of the work of Franz Josef Göll, who's been considered the founder of phrenology, but whose work was nevertheless respected a great deal by later researchers, some of whose own work better stands up to scrutiny today. Do you feel that Göll's reputation and the reputation of his co-workers at the time is excessively maligned?
Yeah, it is maligned. Let me first say what I noticed in the secondary literature on Göll is that most of these articles give the impression that the author didn't read the grand work by Göll. There are not many copies left of that wonderful, huge, big, beautifully edited book. In fact, it is four books in two grand folio size volumes, with a third volume with exactly 100 anatomical plates that Göll drew. That work was published in French, and it is basically not read. So people are mostly citing one or another shorter paper by Göll, and that gives a really the wrong impression about his work. What happened was this: Göll was the first really serious great brain anatomist. He started his work in 1785. That was his dissertation in Vienna, and then began dissecting brains on a daily basis almost, and doing the anatomy of the brain and describing the structures for the first time. It had never been done before. And this book that was published in the years 1810 to 1819 is the result of that grand work. Now, Göll had the important notion that the structure of the brain in some way or another relates to the mental functions that are based on the functioning of the brain. Now, that was not a common view in those times. In fact, Kaiser Franz sent him on Christmas Eve in 1801 a letter which forbade him to lecture because his materialistic lectures and dangerous religion. So it was not obvious to say that the mind is in some way or another run by the brain. He then used some kind of faculty theory, faculties of language, faculties of thinking, faculties of perception, etc., etc. These faculties, he claimed, are somewhere localized in particular regions of the brain. Now, that thought is a modern thought, be it, of course, much more subtle now. But still, I mean, what is it? Two, three years ago, we could read that taxi drivers in London have a bigger hippocampus than other people, because the hippocampus is our region where spatial skills are running. Gall said, okay, when a faculty is well developed, the region is a bit larger. And that is still an idea that has not left us fully. So all this was totally reasonable. It was a reasonable hypothesis to make. And new, really new. So there was his beautiful book. But the problem was, and that has done him not very much good, he had as an assistant, Kaspar Spurzheim. And Kaspar Spurzheim had worked with him on the dissections on the brains, both in Vienna and later in Paris. And he also joined him in writing this grand work. So he participated in writing volume one and a small part of volume two. And then they got into great trouble. Spurzheim left and began his own business. And that business was a business for the popular saloons and the phrenological societies. The term phrenology was introduced by Spurzheim, not by Gall. Gall hated that term. Gall was not a phrenologist. But Spurzheim went around to all these phrenological societies in Edinburgh, in London, in Paris, later in Boston. And he was also the inventor of these popular heads with labels of faculties written on them. And you can still buy them in shops. That was Spurzheim's work. What Gall now does in volume three of his books is open it with 16 pages of diatribe against his former assistant. Spurzheim had published a book of which 254 pages had been plagiarized from their joint texts without mention. That was one. Spurzheim had changed the theory in ways that were just ridiculous, inventing new faculties for which there was no empirical evidence, such as benevolence or supernaturalness, that sort of thing. Spurzheim had made this a popular science, and probably he made quite some money lecturing on these popular things in the saloons, in the phrenological societies and otherwise. Now, that, of course, was in the general public, this was Gall's theory, and so Gall was the crazy phrenologist, but he wasn't. So he has been mistreated in history, and I'm not the first to write that, because this has been mentioned time and again. Also, during the 19th century, he has been applauded for his work in brain anatomy and for his psychological work all over the century. But what you now know and read about Gall is all sort of, yeah, funny. And that's a pity, because he was a great scientist.
Yes, it's another theme that recurs from time to time in the book, that the people who tend to be regarded today rather casually as being somehow fundamentally mistaken in their assumptions,
yep,
actually look a lot more credible on close scrutiny.
Oh, yeah.
Another name that springs to mind in this connection from the 20th century is Benjamin Wolfe. Do you think linguists are neglectful of history, and that extends to dismissing a lot of past projects and somewhat too harshly?
Yes, I would say so. So Wolfe developed a position in linguistics that helped developing a position in linguistics that was certainly an important new development. What I have described in the book as sort of the dominant view in linguistic circles during the 19th century was that languages differ in complexity, and that so-called primitive languages are simpler, are not as much developed as languages such as German, for instance, or at the very top, Old Greek. That was the absolute apex of languages. That notion, which I call the vertical notion, languages differ in complexity, was generally accepted. Wundt, for instance, went so far, still in 1920, in his autobiography, to say, look, people, the history of human thought, of human thinking abilities, is still for the taking. Go out, find all these more primitive, faraway languages, and you can see how human thought developed in the course of evolution. That was the notion. And it was easily coupled with all sorts of other things, such as different races may have a different developmental potential, right? So you get easily into rather risky types of theorizing. Now, during the early 20th century, and then picked up also by Wolfe, came the other idea: languages don't differ in complexity. There's not a linear order of languages. No, they just differ. And then the next step that Wolfe took, and a few others even before him, was, okay, if languages are just different, then their users may have different ways of thinking, different ways of cognizing, dependent on what their language allows them to do. That was the idea, and that's called linguistic relativism. Linguistic relativism goes also very well with the vertical type of theory. If it is the case that languages differ in complexity, then their users will probably differ in the complexity of their thought. Now, this doesn't follow logically at all, of course, but that was a pretty generally shared opinion. Now, in the early 20th century, this more horizontal view, languages are just different, combined with linguistic relativism, when the languages are different, the way of thinking, cognizing is different, that came to be around. And Wolfe was certainly not the first to say that. Some 10 years earlier, the German linguist Weisgerber had produced a book which was precisely doing that. When you read that book, you think you're reading Wolfe. And Wolfe never refers to that book. He had simply hadn't seen it. I don't know whether Wolfe knew German. It could be, because he was generally a good linguist. But anyhow, he didn't know about the work of Weisgerber. So this came to be around. And now that view, combined with relativism, became the hot issue in linguistics. Let's just say a word about what Weisgerber did with it. He said, okay, if your language is such and such, then your thinking must become such and such. So he said, it is not you who think. No, it is the mother tongue in you who thinks. So really totally deterministic. Worf did not go that far. Worf was not really a determinist in terms of linguistic relativity, but he certainly claimed that the ways of thinking between users of different languages could be quite fundamentally different. Now, that hasn't stood the test of time. We now know that this Weltanschauung idea in linguistic relativism, that your language determines your view, your cognizing of the social and physical world around you, that is not tenable. On the other hand, there's also good evidence that your language can provide you with means that make it easier or more obvious to first think in a particular way. But that is not determinism. You can just as well as a speaker from another language think something else. So that strong version of relativism, either in the deterministic way of Weisgerber or in Worf's pretty strong Weltanschauung type of idea, has not survived till the present day. And there have been really, really big fights about it. So that led, the fights, by the way, led to something similar to Galt's case. Worf was accused of the most horrible things in the literature. And that is, again, not truthful. There is now a new edition of Worf's papers with the preface of Stephen Levinson, and that preface really sketches beautifully what the situation of Worf really was and how he has been misconstrued by many, many modern linguists.
The theme of relativism, and in particular the verticality, resurfaces rather forcibly in the 14th and penultimate chapter of your book, which discusses psycholinguistics under the Third Reich. You give very powerful examples of how numerous researchers apparently completely subjugated their scientific principles in order to produce work that was what you might call ideologically sound. Much of which sounds ludicrous, even in the light of what was already known at the time. Were you surprised by how blatant some of this was?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I hadn't expected it. I was not aware of the easy marriage of relativistic ideas, especially in the vertical view, that is, languages differ in complexity, and therefore their users differ in mental ability, how easily that marriage between that vertical view, the relativistic vertical view, and racism was. Races differ in developmental potential. That was an idea also around during the 19th century, but it was very much picked up, of course, happily picked up in the Nazi period. And then, of course, one of the issues to be handled was, are Jews of a different race? And is that race, does it allow for the best things in human power, potential, etc.? And so you find the most awful theorizing about why the Jewish race cannot do what the German, the other German races or the German races can produce and can develop into. It is a horrible literature. And you see how initially serious linguistic work, whether in the domain of vertical theories or horizontal theories, can be abused, can be misused for political reasons. And that happened at a grand scale. So Weisgerber himself became a linguist who functioned in the propaganda machinery of the Nazi regime. And that happened. There were many, many linguists and psycholinguists who played a pretty ugly role there. I give several examples.
The book ends on a more positive note. The first and 15th chapters both cover, as a sort of topping and tailing the book, the period that's commonly and erroneously thought of as the birth of psycholinguistics, 1950s.
Yeah.
You stop at the point where, as you acknowledge in the epilogue, you yourself enter the picture.
Yep.
But you also acknowledge there that personal experience gives the book what you call some hidden touch of autobiography.
Yeah.
Are there any particular ways in which you feel your selection of topics or your perspective is distinctively personal?
No, I don't think my history, my treatment of the earlier history is personal. Personal experiences have certainly informed me. I've had the pleasure to work with both the leaders of the new psycholinguistics of the 1950s and 60s, namely George Miller and Charles Osgood. George Miller had invited me to spend a year as a postdoc fellow at the Center for Cognitive Studies at Harvard, which was directed by himself and Jerome Bruner, whom I also came to know very well, in fact. There I learned to know George as the mathematical psychologist he was at heart. He had introduced Shannon and Weaver's mathematical theory of communication as a new tool for the analysis of sequential behavior, language behavior in particular. And next he had then adopted Chomsky's theory of formal generative grammars, testing the so-called psychological reality of notions such as phrase structure, transformations, deep structure. And it came then really all quite close to me, because I was also auditing Noam Chomsky's courses at MIT, and I've always been on good terms with Noam Chomsky. In fact, he sent me a very kind and extensive email in response to my sending him my book. And I spent another year together with George Miller at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. But then while at Harvard, I received an invitation from Charlie Osgood, who spent a semester with him at Urbana, Illinois. And whereas Miller had quickly abandoned behaviorism under Chomsky's influence, Osgood remained absolutely faithful to his behavioristic mediation theory. It was my first personal confrontation with the behavioristic tradition, which was about to evaporate. And this experience certainly helped me to write in an informed way about that tradition in psycholinguistics. So in short, I still covered my personal memories of Miller, Chomsky, Bruner, Roger Brown, Morris Halle, Roman Jakobson, Eric Lindeberg, and other leaders of the new psycholinguistics. But I don't think it tainted my way of describing that work.
No, indeed not. Our time is nearly up in this interview. I'd like to ask as a final question what comes next. But in particular, in this case, I have to ask whether there's the prospect of an autobiography to provide similar illumination over a large portion of the more recent
history. That is a good question. And of course, when I started writing this book, people said, okay, I hope you will do the full history, huh? At least up to the year 2000. And indeed, initially, I did have that intention. But then slowly but surely, I felt it impossible to do that. And for two reasons. The first one was practical. When I had produced the text roughly up to the Cognitive Revolution, it was already so much that adding a further history up to the year 2000 would probably double the size of the book. And it would be an unusable book. It would be a hopeless thing that nobody would study. So that was not a good thing. But the other thing is much more important. I became a player myself in the modern history of psycholinguistics, in particular since the establishment of the my Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics. And I cannot see how I could write an objective history of the modern, say, last half century of psycholinguistics if I must include describing my own work and the work of my institute. That I cannot do. That somebody else should do. I've been too much of a player in the field myself. So I've decided not to do that, and don't wait for it. It won't come. I did add, however, that I already, in a certain way, described the early history of modern psycholinguistics, that is, the from the cognitive revolution on till 1970s, the first 20 years, I more or less described that and in much detail in my earlier 1974 book on formal grammars in linguistics and psycholinguistics. There you can see how all these formal notions in linguistics were developed and how they were applied and used in the early psycholinguistics, which was much concerned with proving the psychological reality of linguistic notions, such as phrase structure and such as transformations, etc., deep structure. That I all described, and I don't think there is a more comprehensive description of that around. So let people go back to my 1974 book, which was republished in 2008, and they can find that bit of history. But from 1970 on, I won't do it. It's not available. Not from my hand. Not by my hand.
Oh, well, if you decide to recant and write an autobiography following Wundt's example, I shall call back in 20 years to ask you about it.
Well, look, it wouldn't have worked with Wundt. Wundt wrote his autobiography. He published it in 1920. The preface is signed Wilhelm Wundt, Leipzig, August 1920, and he died the same month. That may happen to me too, so good luck.
I'll have to get in quickly. But in the meantime, I wish you many, many more productive years, and thank you for giving this wonderful work.
Thank you so much for interviewing me so extensively.
I've been talking to Pim Leyveld about A History of Psycholinguistics. This is Chris Cummins from New Books in Language saying thank you for listening.